Beckert in his police uniform, and the phone number. Klein concluded, "If you have any information that might help us find this man, please call this number now. You don't need to identify yourself unless you wish to. We just want whatever information you can provide. Thank you." The screen was filled briefly with just the phone number, which was then replaced by a live shot of Stacy Kilbrick and Rory Kronk at their news desk. "Wow," said Kilbrick. "The DA has some big city talent in his little upstate department." "So it seems," said Kronk. "Hmm. How much do we know about this Dave Gurney?" "Well, we know the New York Magazine ran a front-page profile on him a few years ago. The article title was Super Cop, which, I guess, says it all." "So there's no end to the surprises in this story. Great job, Rory." He produced a self-satisfied smirk. "I'm Stacy Kilbrick for Newsbreakers. After these important messages, I'll be back with the latest battle over transgender troops serving in the U.S. Marine Corps." Gurney closed the live stream page and left the RAM website. Madeline was watching him. "Are you concerned about Klein going public with your involvement?" He turned up his palms in a gesture of resignation. "I'd rather he hadn't, but I don't think he's any happier about it than I am." "What do you mean?" "Klein is not a credit sharer. He did it because he was trapped. Kronk was poking at the weakness of his resources and implying that he ought to bring in an outside agency, which Klein absolutely doesn't want to do. He's afraid it would be portrayed as a surrender on his part, and he wants to come out of this with a personal victory. Bragging about my background was a way to beat back Kronk's suggestion that his department couldn't handle the challenge." "I bet that Kilbrick woman tries to get you on her program." "It'll be a snowy day in hell when I say yes to that." He glanced at the time in the corner of the screen. "It's 6:20. You have any ideas about dinner?" She frowned. "Tonight is my dinner meeting with the town political action group. You remember I told you about this, right?"
"I forgot it was tonight."
"I may be late. Our discussions have a way of going on and on. There's all sorts of stuff in the fridge and pasta in the yellow cabinet." An hour later, as he was finishing the plate of spaghetti, diced tomatoes, zucchini, and Parmesan cheese he'd prepared for himself, he got a call from Corey Payne. There was a level of excitement in the young man's voice that Gurney hadn't heard before.
"Dave, are you seeing the news stories on the Internet?"
"About what?"
"The case. It started with RAM News announcing that you guys are focused on my father, who's disappeared. The DA gave an interview about it, and all the other news sites are picking it up. Wild headlines are popping up. Son innocent, father guilty, stuff like that. It's all turned around. I'm not the target anymore. You must know all this, right?"
"I know some significant discoveries have been made."
"That's a mild way of putting it. I feel like I owe you my life."
"It's not over yet."
"But it sounds like everything's finally going in the right direction. Jesus, God, what a relief."
He paused.
"Is this because of stuff you found at his cabin?"
"I can't talk about that. Evidence disclosures would need to come from the DA. But that reminds me, why didn't you tell me about the second key?"
"What?"
"You told me about the key for the cabin, but not the other one for the shed."
"You just lost me."
"The shed behind the cabin."
"I don't know anything about a shed. I've only been to his cabin."
Payne sounded mystified.
"Did he show you the cabin basement?"
"No, I didn't realize it had one."
"Where did he set up his reloading equipment?"
"On a dinner table in the middle of the room."
"What was he wearing?"
"Maybe a flannel shirt. I don't know about his pants. Maybe chinos. He never wore jeans."
"Oh, and some kind of disposable gloves like doctors wear. I think to keep the gunpowder off his hands."
"Since you came to live in White River, how much contact have you had with Judd Turlock?"
"I've seen him with my father. He wasn't the sort of person you'd want to get to know. Even making eye contact with him was scary. One of the news stories said that he was found murdered at the gun club."
"Are you the one who found him?"
"I was there."
"How was he killed?"
"Sorry, that's another one for the DA to answer."
"I understand."
He paused.
"Well, the main reason I called was to thank you. Thank you for giving me back my life."
Now Gurney paused.
"I have another question. When you were a kid, before you got sent to that boarding school, did your father try to interest you in guns or hunting or anything like that?"
There was a long silence. When Payne finally replied, the excitement had drained from his voice.
My father never tried to interest me in anything. The only concern he had was that I never do anything that might embarrass him.
Gurney felt an unpleasant tremor of recognition. There was a time when he had a similar resentment toward his own father.
48. He wasn't sure what to do next. He had the feeling that things were coming to a head, and he needed to press forward. While the next step was eluding him, he decided to check his phone to make sure he was up to date with his messages. There was just one, the call from Thrasher, that had come in while he was watching Battleground Tonight. He pressed the play icon.
Detective Gurney, Walter Thrasher here. No doubt the non-stop horrors of White River are absorbing your attention, but I feel the need to fill you in on the even more gruesome history of your own idyllic hillside. Call when you can. In the meantime, I'd strongly advise you not to do any more excavating, not until I prepare you for what you're likely to find.
Gurney felt a surge of curiosity and alarm. He called Thrasher back immediately, got his voicemail, and left a message. Then he forced his attention back to the White River affair and what unresolved aspect he should address first. The ice pick murder of Rick Loomis came to mind, which in turn reminded him of the hospital personnel list and the fact that he still hadn't examined the section covering employees who had resigned or been terminated. He went to his desk, got out the USB drive containing the list, and inserted it in his laptop. A few moments later, he was opening the res term section of the Mercy Hospital Consolidated Personnel file. As he went through the columns of names and addresses, he recognized only one name, but it definitely got his attention. Jackson, Blaze L., 115 Borden Street, White River, New York. Her resignation or termination, the file didn't indicate which, had occurred on February 12th, just 3 months earlier. The remaining data was limited to her landline and cell phone numbers. As he was entering this information in his address book, the Borden Street location was ringing a faint bell. He was sure he'd seen that address before, but he couldn't place where. He opened Google Street View and entered the address, but what he saw wasn't familiar. He returned to the personnel list and looked again at the address. That's when it occurred to him that it wasn't the physical location that was ringing a bell. It was the typed address on the file page. He'd seen that address somewhere else in the same document. He went to the main part of the list that was devoted to active employees and began scrolling slowly through the names and addresses. Finally, there it was, in the section covering security, maintenance, and housekeeping. Creel, Charlize J., 115 Borden Street, White River, New York. The landline number given for her was the same as the one listed for Blaze Jackson, but she had a different cell number. So, thought Gurney, they were roommates at least, and possibly more than that. Just as interesting was the fact that Charlize Creel was a name he'd seen before, and not just in the personnel list. It had appeared on the name tag of the cleaning woman on the ICU floor at the hospital. The woman with the almond-shaped eyes who'd emptied the trash basket in the visitor's lounge the day he was there with Kim, Heather, and Madeline. A woman who would have had easy access to Rick Loomis. A woman whose routine presence the nursing staff would have had no reason to question. The insertion of the ice pick, however, into Loomis's brainstem would have required specific medical knowledge, which raised questions about Creel's background, as well as Jackson's. Gurney needed to find out what Jackson's job at the hospital had been, and the reason she was no longer there. Could the Jackson-Creel relationship be connected directly to the murder of Rick Loomis? Might one of them have been the source of the drugs used on Jordan and Tooker? And perhaps the biggest question of all, were Jackson and Creel entangled with Judd Turlock and Del Beckert? The hospital seemed the logical place to start searching for answers. Gurney's call was answered by an automated branching system that connected him eventually to Abby Marsh in the HR department. She was still in her office at 8:15. She sounded as harried as she was the day Gurney had gotten the file from her.
"Yes."
"Abby, this is Dave Gurney. I was wondering if..." She broke in.
"The man of the hour."
"Sorry." We have a TV in our cafeteria. I was grabbing a quick dinner and saw the interview with the district attorney. What can I do for you?
I need some information on two of your employees. One past, one present. Blaze Jackson and Charlize Creel. Are you familiar with them?
Jackson, definitely. Creel, slightly. Is there a problem?
That's what I'm trying to find out. Is Creel working now?
Hold on, I'll check. Okay, here it is. According to the schedule, she's on the 4-12 shift, so yes, she'd be working now.
Sorry, what I meant was, do you know for a fact that she's actually there?
That wouldn't be in our computer system.
But someone must know whether she's there or not.
Her shift supervisor, do you want me to call him?
Please.
I'm going to put you on hold.
Thank you, Abby.
5 minutes passed. When she finally reconnected with Gurney, she sounded worried. Charlize Creel didn't show up for her shift this afternoon. She didn't show up yesterday, and she didn't call in either day. Her supervisor tried to reach her yesterday. When he tried again today, he got an automated message saying her voicemail was full.
She's been reliable until now?
Apparently. No red flags in her file. But the fact that you're asking about her, is that something we should be concerned about?
Too soon to tell. Did you know that she has the same address as Blaze Jackson?
The same address?
The worry in Abby Marsh's voice went up a notch. Yes, and the same landline number. Marsh said nothing.
Rather than ask whether Jackson had resigned or been terminated, a question that Marsh might not be able to answer for privacy reasons, Gurney employed the presumptive approach detectives often used in dealing with similar situations. When Jackson was terminated, were there any repercussions?
What kind of repercussions?
Did she deny what she was being accused of?
Of course, until we showed her our pharmacy security video.
Gurney decided to continue his presumptive approach.
She had the propofol in her possession, and the midazolam?
The propofol was right there on the video. The midazolam would have been harder to prove. Bottom line, she agreed to resign, and we agreed not to press charges. There would have been no point. Propofol is not technically a controlled substance like midazolam, so legally the charges wouldn't have amounted to much.
But who gave you all this information?
Gurney was tempted to tell her that she just did, but revealing that he'd tricked her would do no one any good, and he wasn't particularly proud of it. He said instead, not untruthfully, "The truth has a way of leaking out." She paused.
"Can you tell me why you're looking for Charlize Creel?"
He worded his answer conservatively. She may have been in the vicinity of the ICU at the time Rick Loomis was attacked. Abby Marsh's dead silence indicated that she got the point. The first thing Gurney did after thanking her for her help and ending the call was to check Creel's landline and cell numbers and place calls to them both. Both calls went to voicemail, and both mailboxes were full. He placed a call to Jackson's cell number. That call also went to voicemail, and that mailbox was also full. He sat back in his chair and gazed out the rear window at the hillside, now almost entirely enveloped in darkness. Somewhere in the high pine forest, a coyote pack began to howl. He thought about the link between Blaze Jackson and Charlize Creel. He thought about their unwillingness or inability to accept phone calls, about Jackson's drug-related exit from Mercy Hospital, about Creel's access to the ICU. After a quarter of an hour of indecision, he called Torres.
"Mark, there's a situation we need to look into."
He related his conversation with Abby Marsh and asked Torres to get over to the Jackson Creel apartment as soon as possible. "If either one of them is present, hold on to them. I'll meet you there." He drove well above the speed limit all the way to the White River exit on the interstate, then relied on his GPS to lead him through the city's maze of one-way streets. His destination turned out to be in the middle of a ragged block in the Grinton neighborhood. In the light of the sole functioning street lamp, the side of Borden Street on which number 115 was located appeared intact. On the opposite side, only burned-out shells remained. Torres's Crown Victoria was already there. Gurney pulled in behind it. Getting out of his car, he was struck by the sharp odor of wet ashes and underlying decay. Like the adjoining structures to its left and right, number 115 was a grimy four-story tenement with a steel door.
A man and a woman were sitting in plastic lawn chairs in the semi-darkness in front of the building. The man was small, wiry, and brown-skinned, with an unkempt gray afro. The woman was blonde and remarkably rotund, creating an impression of having been inflated. Her face was illuminated by the cold glow of her phone screen. The man watched Gurney approaching.
"Apartment you wants on the fourth floor," he announced in a loud voice. "Man who came before you's been up there a while."
Gurney stopped.
"Do you happen to know the women who live there, Blaze Jackson and Shelley's Creel?"
The man grinned.
"Everybody knows Miss Lovely. She's famous."
"What about Shelley's?"
"Shelley's don't talk to nobody."
"Have you seen either of them in the past few days?"
"Don't believe so."
Gurney looked at the woman. "How about you? Do you know either of the ladies on the fourth floor?" She showed no sign of hearing the question. The man leaned forward in his lawn chair.
"Brenda only knows what's on her phone."
Gurney nodded. "Do you know if the ladies had any recent visitors?"
"Brothers coming and going all the time."
"Anyone else?"
"Man in the big car a couple days back."
Gurney pointed to the Crown Vic. "Big car like that?"
"Taller, more shine.
Cowboy kind of name."
"Durango?"
"Yeah, pretty sure, Durango."
"You saw the driver?"
"White man, saw him from a window."
He pointed toward the second floor. "Can you describe him?"
"I just did."
"Tall, short, thin, fat?"
"Regular size."
"Type of clothing?"
"Dark."
"Hair color, length?"
"Dark hat, didn't see no hair."
"And this was when?"
"Had to be night before last."
"Do you know what time he arrived?"
"Night time, maybe 10, 11.
"Do you know how long he was here?"
"The man came in the night is all I know. Car was gone in the morning."
Gurney was considering his next question when he heard his name being called. He looked up and saw Torres at an open window on the top floor.
"Dave, you need to come up here."
The strain in his voice gave Gurney a hint of what to expect when he reached the apartment. Gurney entered the building and bounded up through the stairwell two steps at a time. The fourth-floor apartment door was open, held that way by Torres, who stepped back to let Gurney into a narrow foyer lighted by a single ceiling fixture. He handed Gurney a pair of latex gloves and Tyvek shoe covers. Gurney put them on without asking any questions. He knew he'd have the answers soon enough.
"They're in the living room," said Torres.
The sickening smell that intensified as Gurney passed through the foyer was one he knew well but had never gotten used to. Two African-American women in short skirts and satin tops were sitting on the living room couch. They were leaning against each other, as though, instead of going out for the evening, they'd fallen asleep in the middle of an intimate conversation. Looking closer, Gurney could see on their skin the characteristic sheen of autolysis. In addition, there were signs that the first gases of decomposition were beginning to bloat their bodies. But the faces were still recognizable. He was sure the one on the left belonged to the fiery woman he'd seen on Ram TV's Battleground Tonight. And he had a feeling that the face on the right belonged to the almond-eyed cleaning woman he'd seen in the ICU visitor's lounge. As was usually the case with corpses at this stage, flies were everywhere, most thickly concentrated on the mouths, eyes, and ears. The apartment's two front windows were wide open, likely an effort by Torres to mitigate the stench. There were two empty glasses, open bottles of vodka and raspberry liqueur, and two glittery purses on the coffee table in front of the couch, along with a number of hypodermic needles. Gurney counted 8, all used and empty. Their labels indicated they were of the preloaded type containing propofol.
"Blaze Lovely Jackson and Charlie's Jackson Creel," said Torres. "At least that's what it says on the driver's licenses in those purses. Sounds like they might be sisters."
Gurney nodded. "Have you called the ME's office?"
"Thrasher said he could be here in 25 minutes, and that was 20 minutes ago. I called Garrett Felder, too. He's on his way."
"Good. You've been to the apartment?"
"A general look around."
"Anything get your attention?"
"One thing, actually."
Torres pointed to a small desk against the wall opposite the couch. He opened the top drawer all the way.
In the back, behind a ream of paper, there was a plastic zip-top bag containing what appeared to be a stack of $20 bills. Gurney guesstimated the total, if they were all twenties, to be at least $3,000. He frowned. Interesting. The money? And the plastic bag. The bag? Why? Torres's question was truncated by the sound of a car door closing in the street below. 49. Shortly after Thrasher's arrival, Garrett Felder came trudging up the stairs with his evidence collection equipment, followed by Paul Aziz with his camera. While the three donned their Tyvek suits, Torres acquainted them with the basic facts of the situation, after which he and Gurney took a low-profile position, mostly observing the technical work in progress and being careful not to get in the way. From time to time, Felder and Aziz expressed their dismay at the odor that had permeated the apartment. Thrasher acted as if it didn't exist. After watching them for a while, Torres took Gurney aside and informed him that he'd been contacted earlier that day by the lead singer of an obscure old rock band. He told me he'd heard a news report a few days ago that members of a white supremacist group called Knights of the Rising Sun were wanted by the police in White River. That would have been when Turlock and Beckett were publicly linking the KRS website to the Jordan Tooker murders and to the Gorts. Anyway, the news reporter included the website address in the story. The rock band guy got curious and went to the site because he remembered the phrase Knights of the Rising Sun was in one of his old songs. Gurney chimed in, and on the website he found the video of him and his band performing that song. But he didn't know anything about any white supremacist group, and his band had never given anyone the rights to the video. Torres looked baffled. How on earth do you know that? It's the only way it would make sense, considering the fact that the whole KRS business was a fabrication. I figure the website creator found the old video somewhere, maybe on YouTube, copied it and used it. I'd also bet that the band's actual name has the phrase white supremacist or words to that effect in it. Torres stared at Gurney. He told me his band, as sort of a joke, was named the Texas Skinhead White Supremacy Heavy Metal Rockers. But how could you possibly know that? Once it was apparent that the KRS thing was a form of misdirection, I asked myself how I'd go about creating a phony website like that. Rather than trying to invent the content from scratch, I'd do an internet search of terms like white supremacist to see what was out there, what I could adapt to just plain steal. The next step... Thrasher interrupted their conversation. Cadaver van'll be here momentarily. Time of death I'd put in a window of 48 to 72 hours ago. I may be able to be a bit more precise when I get them open, day after tomorrow, if nothing unforeseen occurs. Meanwhile, it looks similar in both cases to the chemical preamble to the Jordan and Tooker homicides. I would expect our lab results to reveal alcohol, metabolites of midazolam, and signs of propofol toxicity. Why midazolam? Asked Gurney. Aren't the other benzodiazepines more readily available? Generally, yes. Then why? Anterograde amnesia. What's that? One of the special effects of midazolam is to impair the creation of memories. That might be advantageous to a perpetrator in a criminal situation, in case the victim survived. There could, of course, be other reasons for its selection. Up to you to sort that out. He pointed at one of the bottles on the coffee table. While you're at it, I suggest you get an analysis of that raspberry liqueur. Any reason in particular? Asked Gurney, his annoyance rising at Thrasher's habit of doling out information in pieces rather than laying it all out at once. Midazolam is available as a syrup, has a bitter taste. A strong sweet liqueur might be an ideal delivery vehicle. I take it there's no chance of this being a double suicide. I wouldn't say no chance, but damn little chance. Thrasher stepped out of the living room into the little foyer and began removing his Tyvek suit. Gurney followed him. By the way, I got your phone message. Thrasher nodded, peeling off his latex gloves. I'd like to know what this excavation mystery is all about, said Gurney. When can we sit down and talk about it? How about right now? Thrasher produced an unpleasant smile. The subject is a sensitive one. This is neither the time nor the place. Then pick a time and place. Thrasher's smile hardened. Your house, tomorrow evening. I'm speaking at the annual dinner of the Forensic Pathology Association in Syracuse. I should be passing through Walnut Crossing on my way there around 5. I'll see you then.
Thrasher rolled up his Tyvek coveralls, removed his shoe covers, stuffed everything in an expensive-looking leather bag, and left without another word. Gurney returned to Torres in the living room, intending to resume his explanation of the likely KRS website creation process, when Garrett Felder came over, smartphone in hand, obviously excited.
Look at this.
He held up his phone so Torres and Gurney could both see the screen. It displayed side-by-side photos of 2 thumbprints. They appeared to be identical.
Clean, shiny, non-porous surfaces are a godsend. Look at these prints. Like they get on TV. Perfect.
Gurney and Torres peered at them.
There's no doubt these 2 came from the same thumb, continued Felder. Different time, different place, but the same thumb. Print on the left I just lifted from the plastic bag of 20s in the desk drawer. Print on the right I lifted yesterday from an alarm clock in the loft of Del Beckard's cabin. It also matches a bunch of prints on his furniture, his faucets, his UTV.
Do we know for a fact those prints in the cabin are Beckard's? Asked Gurney. Felder nodded.
Confirmation yesterday from APHIS, from their file of active Leo prints.
Torres seemed taken aback.
Jackson and Creel got that money directly from Beckard?
We know Jackson did, said Felder. Her prints and Beckard's are both on the bag.
You took prints from Jackson's body? Asked Gurney.
Quick ones.
Thrasher'll do the official set at autopsy. Anyway, I've got more work to do now. Just wanted to clue you in.
Felder slipped his phone through a slit in his Tyvek coverall into his pocket and headed for a hallway off the side of the living room. On the wall next to the hallway, there was a poster-sized print of a famous 60s radical thrusting an iconic black power fist into the air. A moment later, Paul Aziz came out of the same hallway. He announced that he'd finished. Patting his camera affectionately, he asked if Gurney or Torres had any special requests beyond the standard crime scene collection. Torres looked questioningly at Gurney, who said no. Aziz promised to email them photo sets the following morning and was gone. Torres turned to Gurney with a puzzled look.
This financial connection between Del Beckard and Blaze Jackson, it doesn't seem to surprise you.
I'm only surprised that we found such clear evidence of it. When the hospital HR director admitted that Jackson was fired for stealing propofol hypodermics and propofol hypodermics had been found on Beckard's property, it was natural to suspect a connection.
You think the money was Beckard's payment to her for the drugs?
Gurney shrugged. It would seem to be payment for something. We need to know more about what went on between them. Obviously, the chief of police wouldn't ask a leader of the BDA to steal propofol for him unless they had an established relationship.
Torres looked baffled.
Like what?
There are some interesting possibilities. Remember that revelation a few years back that one of the biggest mobsters in Boston was a major FBI informant?
Torres's eyes widened.
You think Jackson was fingering people for Beckard?
We've heard she was ambitious and ruthless. She could have been selectively informing on people she wanted out of her way. It could have been a useful association that got deeper as time passed. It's not inconceivable that they collaborated on the elimination of Jordan and Tooker, an outcome we've been told they may both have wanted for their own reasons.
Are you suggesting Beckard did this?
Torres gestured toward the couch.
The guy downstairs in the lawn chair claims that a white man in a black Durango was here 2 nights ago, just within Thrasher's time of death window.
Jesus, said Torres softly.
Gurney looked over at the bottles and glasses on the table and Jackson and Creel in their party clothes.
Maybe Beckard suggested a little toast to their success.
Torres picked up the hypothetical narrative.
The midazolam in the drinks relaxes them to the point of not knowing what's going on. Then he injects them with fatal overdoses of propofol and just leaves everything there so it'll look like a drug party gone bad.
He hesitated, frowning.
But why kill them?
Gurney smiled. The demon of negative projection.
What?
Let's assume that Beckard relied on their help to get rid of people who could cause problems for him. At least Jordan and Tooker, and probably Loomis in the hospital. But that put them in a position where they could cause even bigger problems because of what they knew.
Once he started envisioning situations in which they might roll over on him or even try to blackmail him, that would have done it. His political future and personal safety would have been far more important to him than the lives of two potential troublemakers. Torres nodded slowly.
You think he might have set Turlock up by sending him out to the gun club and letting the Gorts know he'd be there? I mean, Turlock probably knew more damaging stuff about him than anyone else on Earth, and if he'd outlived his usefulness.
And that would depend on Beckert being in contact with the Gorts, which...
Torres's phone rang. He frowned at the screen.
It's the DA's office.
He listened intently for a minute or two. The only sound in the apartment was the hum of Felder's evidence vac as he ran it slowly over the rug in front of the couch.
Torres finally spoke.
Okay. Yes, I know the area.
Right, it looks that way.
I agree. Thank you.
He ended the call and turned to Gurney.
That was the woman in Klein's office who's taking calls in response to his TV request for information on Beckert's whereabouts.
Anything useful?
A caller said he saw a man earlier tonight in a gas station over near Bass River. The man was filling a couple of 5-gallon gas cans in the back of a black Durango. The Durango plate number ended with the letters WRPD.
Did the caller identify himself?
No.
He asked if there was a reward. She told him there wasn't, and he hung up.
Phone company says the call came from a prepaid.
Does Klein's office have a recording of it?
No, the line they're using bypasses their automatic system.
Too bad.
Gurney paused.
Bass River's out by the reservoir, right?
Right, other side of the mountain from the gun club, heavily forested land. Not many roads.
Torres eyed Gurney's expression.
Something about that bother you?
I'm just thinking that if Beckert's on the run, it's surprising he's still in the area.
Maybe he's got a second cabin nobody knows about. In the woods somewhere, off the grid. Maybe that's what the gas cans were for, a generator. What do you think?
I guess it's possible.
You sound doubtful.
Driving his own vehicle with a distinctive plate number close to home seems like a stupid thing to do.
People make mistakes under pressure, right?
True, said Gurney.
In fact, he thought with a twinge of anxiety, he might be doing that himself.
50. It was after midnight when Gurney got home from White River. He parked by the side door. The thought occurred to him, as it had done on many previous occasions, that it would make sense to add a garage to the house. It was something Madeline had mentioned from time to time, and it was the sort of thing they could work on together. After the case was wrapped up, he'd have to give the project some serious thought. Before going into the house, he stood for a while next to the outback in the moonlight, inhaling the sweet earthy spring air, an antidote to the odor of death he had experienced earlier. However, the nights were a lot chillier up in the hills around Walnut Crossing than down in White River, and it wasn't long before a shiver persuaded him to go inside. Despite feeling wired from the intense evening, he decided to lie down, close his eyes, and try to get some rest. Madeline was asleep, but when he got into bed, she woke up enough to murmur,
"You're home."
"Yes."
"Everything all right?"
"More or less."
It took a moment for that to register.
"What's the less part?"
"The White River thing keeps getting crazier. How was your political action meeting?"
"Stupid. Tell you about it in the morning."
"Okay, good night."
"Good night."
"Love you."
"Love you too."
A minute later, the soft rhythm of her breathing told him she was asleep. As he lay staring out the open window at the shapes of the trees, just visible in the silvery moonlight, his thoughts centered on the relationship between Del Beckert and Blaze Jackson. He wondered if she might have been the unnamed informant referred to more than once in the critical situation management team meetings. Did Beckert have something on her that forced her cooperation, or had the initiative been hers? Was the bag of money in the drawer a one-time transaction, or was it part of an ongoing arrangement? Was it a payment for value received or money extorted in return for silence? Given Jackson's physical attractiveness and reputed sexual appetite, might her connection to Beckert have included that element? Or was it purely a business relationship? And what about the Rick Loomis connection? If Beckert and Turlock were behind the Poulter Street attempt on Loomis's life,
then presumably they were also behind the fatal attack in the hospital. Did Beckert and Jackson enlist Charlize Creel and show her how to drive that ice pick into the man's brainstem? The thought of Poulter Street reminded Gurney of a question he'd asked Torres to pursue. Had the real estate agent who'd arranged for the leases on the two sniper sites actually met with Jordan, whose name was on the leases? Or had the transaction been handled by an intermediary? Torres had told Gurney the information would be available as soon as the agent returned from vacation. Gurney's eagerness to pursue the matter, along with the impossibility of doing so at 2 o'clock in the morning, kept him spinning what-if scenarios until he finally drifted into an uneasy sleep. When he awoke at 9 the next morning, the sky was blue, and through the open windows he could hear Madeline out mowing. His first thought was to get in touch with Acme Realty. He called Mark Torres for the agent's name, which had slipped his mind. "Laura Conway," said Torres. "I have a reminder on my phone to check with her this morning. I'm on my way into Klein's office to brief him on the Jackson Creel homicides. By the way, we've confirmed that Blaze and Charlize are sisters, and it seems that Charlize has a pretty extensive mental health history, which we're trying to get access to. As for Laura Conway, if you want to talk to her yourself..." "I do. Can you give me the number?" 3 minutes later, Laura Conway was telling him what he'd half expected to hear. "It was all handled by Blaze Jackson. I believe she was Mr. Jordan's business manager or something like that. She chose the apartment on Bridge Street and the house over on Poulter."
"But both of those leases were signed by Marcel Jordan?"
"That's correct. As I remember, Miss Jackson took the physical documents to him and brought them back to our office."
"Were you aware of her prominent role in the Black Defense Alliance?"
"I have no interest in politics. I avoid watching the news. It's too upsetting."
"So you never met Marcel Jordan?"
"No."
"Or spoke to him?"
"No."
"Did he provide you with any financial references?"
"No."
"You didn't require assurances that he could afford those rentals?"
"We didn't consider it necessary."
"Isn't that unusual?"
"It's not the normal thing, but neither was the arrangement."
"Meaning?"
"Both rentals were paid for in advance, for the entire year, in cash."
"Did that concern you?"
"Some people like cash transactions. I don't question things like that."
"Did it cross your mind that Mr. Jordan might not know that his name was on that lease?"
"I don't understand. Why wouldn't he know?"
Gurney was sure the answer was that Jordan was being set up in a complex Beckert-Turlock conspiracy to frame him and his BDA associates, along with Corey Payne, for the murders of John Steele and Rick Loomis. So he wasn't surprised to learn of the man's potential ignorance of the lease. What got his attention was the presence of Blaze Jackson, with its suggestion of her involvement in the affair from the beginning. He ended the call and stood for a minute at the window, gazing out at the row of blooming chokecherry trees along the side of the high pasture. He was wondering how extensively involved Blaze Jackson had been in the White River deaths, and whether she had been the brains or the tool. As he was turning this over in his mind, his eye caught a movement in the sky above the trees. A red-tailed hawk was circling the edge of the field, searching no doubt for some smaller bird or furry creature to pierce with its talons, tear apart and devour. Nature, he concluded for the 100th time, for all its sweetness and blossoms and birdsong, was essentially a horror show. His phone rang on the nightstand behind him. He turned away from the window and took the call.
"Gurney here?"
"Hello, Dave. It's Marv Gelter."
"Marv, good morning."
"Good and busy is what it is. You're quite the disruptor, my friend. Whole new political landscape out there."
Gurney remained silent.
"No time to waste. Let me get to the point. You free for lunch?"
"That would depend on the agenda."
"Of course it would. The agenda concerns your future. You just turned the world upside down, my friend. Time to take advantage of that. Time to take a look at the rest of your life."
Gurney's visceral dislike of Gelter was outweighed by his curiosity.
"Where do you want to meet?"
"The Blue Swan, Lochinberry, 12 noon.
By the time he was ready to leave, Madeline's mowing had taken her up around the high pasture into one of the grassy trails through the pines. He left her a note with a brief explanation, hoping he'd be back by 3 that afternoon.
Then he got the address of the restaurant from the internet, put it into his GPS, and set out. The immaculate village of Lochinberry, just a mile or so past the Gelters' strange cubicle house, was nestled in its own small valley, where spring was further advanced than in the neighboring hills. Daffodils, jonquils, and apple blossoms were already giving way to a profusion of lilacs. The Blue Swan was located on a tranquil, shaded lane off the main street. An elegantly understated sign beside a bluestone path leading to the front door was all that distinguished it from the picture book colonial homes on either side of it. Gurney was met in the Cherrywood entry hall by a statuesque blonde with a faint Scandinavian accent.
"Welcome, Mr. Gurney. Mr. Gelter will be here shortly. May I show you to your table?"
He followed her along a carpeted hallway to a high-ceilinged room with a chandelier. The walls consisted of alternating panels of Impressionist-style floral murals and gleaming mirrors. There was a single table in the center of the room, round with a white linen tablecloth, two French provincial dining chairs, and two elaborate place settings. The statuesque blonde pulled out one of the chairs for him.
"May I get you something to drink, Mr. Gurney?"
"Plain water." Moments later, Marv Gelter strode into the room, concentrated energy and darting gaze belying the laid-back look of his country squire tweeds. It was as though a Ralph Lauren weekend ensemble was being modeled by a large caffeinated rat.
"Dave, glad you made it. Sorry to be late."
He sat across the table from Gurney, glancing back toward the hallway.
"Lover, darling, where the hell are you?"
The Nordic beauty entered the room, bringing them two glasses on a silver tray, plain water for Gurney and a rosy-hued drink that looked like a Campari and soda for Gelter. She placed them on the table, stood back, and waited. Gelter took a quick swallow of his. Gurney wondered if he did anything slowly.
"No menu here, David. They do the classics. Fantastic cassoulet, coq au vin, confit de canard, bœuf bourguignon. Whatever you like."
Gurney looked up at the Nordic beauty, who seemed faintly amused.
"The beef," he said.
She smiled and left the room. He looked at Gelter.
"You're not eating?" "They know what I like."
He took another swig of his drink and grinned with more adrenaline than warmth.
"So, you triggered an earthquake. How's it feel?"
"Unfinished."
"Ha, unfinished. I like that. A man who's never satisfied. Always moving forward. Good, very good."
He eyed Gurney with a glittery intensity.
"So here we are. Del Beckert, God rest his soul, is a dead issue. Even if he's alive, he's dead. You saw to that. Fine. The question is, what's next?"
"Next for who?"
"You, David. You're the one I'm having lunch with. What's next for you?"
Gurney shrugged. "Mow my fields, feed my chickens, build a bigger woodshed." Gelter pursed his lips unpleasantly.
"Klein'll probably make you an offer, maybe to run his investigation department. That's something you'd like?"
"No."
"I don't blame you, waste of your talents, which are more substantial than you know."
The adrenaline grin returned.
"You've got a shitload of modesty, shitload of integrity, big balls. You walked into that White River cesspool when nobody knew what the fuck was going on. You figured it out, showed the district attorney which end was up. That's impressive."
He paused.
"You know what else it is? It's a story. A story with a hero. A cool, smart, straight-shooter hero. Super cop. That's what that magazine called you, am I right?"
Gurney nodded uncomfortably.
"Damn, David, you are the man. You even have those old blue-eyed cowboy good looks. A goddamn real-life hero. You know how deep a hunger there is out there for a real hero?"
Gurney stared at him.
"What are you talking about?" "The hell you think I'm talking about? Becker's out. Gurney's in."
"In what?"
"The office of the Attorney General."
The Nordic beauty appeared with two delicate china plates. The one with an artfully arranged antipasto she placed in front of Gurney, the one with a dozen or so mandarin orange segments arranged in a circle around a small finger bowl she placed in front of Gelter. She left the room as quietly as she'd entered it. Gurney's tone matched his incredulous expression.
"You're suggesting I compete in the special election?" "I can see you winning it by a bigger margin than Beckert would have."
Gurney was silent for a long moment.
You don't seem upset by what's happened.
I was extremely upset for 10 minutes. More than that's a self-indulgent waste of time. Then I asked myself the only sane question, what now? It doesn't matter what life puts in front of us. Could be a gold mine, could be a pile of crap. The question's the same, what now?
Does it bother you that you were so wrong about Beckert?
Gelter picked up a little wedge of orange and examined it before popping it in his mouth.
Life goes on. If people disappoint you, fuck 'em. Problems can become solutions, like this situation right here. You're better than Beckert, which I might not have realized if he was still around. That worthless lump of socialist shit, Maynard Biggs, won't have a chance against you.
You hate him that much?
He examined another orange wedge before devouring it.
I don't hate him. Don't give a flying fuck about him. What I hate is what he stands for. The philosophy, the belief system, the entitlement.
The entitlement?
With a capital fucking E. These useless fuckers have rights, rights to whatever they want. No need to work, save, support their own children, no need to do a damn thing. Because they had a great-great-great-great fucking grandfather who 300 fucking years ago got sold by some African scumbag to a slave trader. This ancient history, you see, entitles them to the fruits of my current labor.
He turned his head to the side and spit an orange seed out onto the oriental carpet. Gurney shrugged.
The one time I saw Biggs on television, his statements on the racial divide seemed mild and reasonable.
Pretty rapping on a box of scorpions.
And you see me as some sort of solution to this.
I see you as a way to keep the levers of power out of the wrong hands.
If I were to be elected with your help, what would I owe you?
Nada. The defeat of Maynard Biggs would be my payment.
I'll sleep on it.
Fine, but don't sleep too long. There's a filing deadline 3 days from now. Say yes, and I promise you you'll win.
You really don't think Biggs has a chance?
Not against you. And I could always turn up a few students who might recall instances of inappropriate advances from their professor.
Gelter smiled venomously.
Gelter's main course arrived, a colorful bouillabaisse, followed by Gurney's boeuf bourguignon. They ate, mostly in silence, and both declined dessert. The subject of their meeting wasn't mentioned again until they were out in front of the restaurant, about to get into their cars.
As soon as you say yes, said Gelter, we'll put you on Newsbreakers and have Kilbrick and Kronk introduce you to the world. They're both dying to talk to you.
When Gurney didn't reply, he continued.
Just think about what you could do with the power and influence of the AG title. All the right contacts, whole new world. I know people who'd kill for that spot.
I'll let you know.
Opportunity of a lifetime,
Gelter added, flashing his adrenaline-charged grin one more time as he stepped into his red Ferrari. 51.
Gurney sipped the cup of coffee he'd made the minute he'd arrived home from Lochinbury. Purple finches were busy at the feeder Madeline had set up at the edge of the patio. She was at the sink island, chopping onions for soup.
So, she said lightly, what did he want?
It wants me to run for attorney general.
The knife paused on the cutting board, but she didn't look as surprised as he'd expected.
In place of Del Beckert?
Exactly.
She nodded thoughtfully.
I guess he wants a real law and order hero to replace the one that blew up in his face.
That's pretty much what he said.
He didn't waste any time?
Nope.
Clever, cold, and calculating.
All of that.
And it goes without saying that he has the connections to get you in the race?
Not just that, he told me I'd win.
What did you say to that?
That I'd sleep on it.
What were you thinking when you said it?
I was thinking that after 2 minutes of feeling flattered, I'd ponder the unknowns, imagine the problems, talk to you about it, then turn it down.
She laughed. Interesting process. What does the Attorney General do, anyway?
I'm sure there's a description of responsibilities on the state website, but what a real-life person might choose to spend his time on is another matter. The last occupant of the office is rumored to have fucked himself to death with a Las Vegas hooker.
So you're really not interested?
In jumping into a political shark tank? With the backing of a man I don't even like being in the same room with?
Madeline raised a curious eyebrow.
You did agree to have lunch with him.
To find out why he wanted to have lunch with me.
And now you know.
Now I know, unless his agenda is more twisted than I realize.
She gave him one of her searching looks, and a silence fell between them.
Oh, by the way, he said as he was finishing his coffee, I crossed paths with Walter Thrasher at the crime scene in White River last night. He said he'd drop by around 5 today to talk about our archaeology project.
What is there to talk about?
Gurney realized he hadn't shared Thrasher's phone message with her. He's done some research on the objects I found. His comments have been rather strange. I'm hoping he'll clarify the situation this afternoon.
Madeline's silence eloquently conveyed her hostility to the project. Thinking of Thrasher reminded him of the Jackson Creel apartment. Madeline reacted to the look on his face.
What is it?
Nothing, just a little jolt from last night. I'm fine.
You want to tell me about it?
He didn't want to, but he'd learned over the years that describing something that was disturbing him loosened its grip on his mind. So he told her the story, beginning with his discovery on the hospital personnel list that Blaze Jackson and Charlize Creel shared an address, and ending with the scene in the apartment. The decomposing bodies, the propofol hypodermics, the money, and the fingerprint link to Del Beckert. She smiled.
You must feel good about that.
About what? There was sourness in his voice.
Being right about Beckert? You were uncomfortable with him from the beginning, and now you've amassed all this evidence of his involvement in... how many murders?
At least 4. 6 if he killed those 2 women. 7 if he set up Judd Turlock.
If it wasn't for you, that pain boy would probably be in jail.
He shook his head. I doubt it. A good defense lawyer would have seen that the evidence against him was a setup. As for the evidence against Beckert, we got lucky out at the gun club.
You're not giving yourself enough credit. You're the one who decided to go there and check it out. You're the one who turned the whole case around. You're the one who's gotten to the truth.
We've had some luck. Recoverable bullets, clean ballistics, clear evidence that...
She interrupted him. You don't sound very proud of what you've accomplished.
And you sound like you're talking to one of your clients at the clinic.
She sighed. I'm just wondering why you don't feel better about the progress you've made.
I'll feel better when it's all over.
Thrasher arrived at 5:20, negotiating the uneven lane up through the pasture with obvious care in his pristine Audi. After getting out of the car, he stood for a few moments, surveying the surrounding landscape, then came over to the open French doors.
Damned construction workers on the interstate, busily doing nothing except impeding traffic, he said as Gurney let him in.
From his position in the breakfast nook, he looked around the big farmhouse kitchen with an appraising eye. His gaze lingered on the fireplace at the far end.
Nice old mantle. Chestnut. Unique color. Style of the hearth appears to be early 1800s.
You researched the provenance of the house when you bought it?
No.
You think there's some connection between this house and...
The remains of the house down by the pond?
Lord, no.
That predates this by more than 100 years.
He put his briefcase down on the dining table. Madeline, who'd been upstairs practicing a Bach piece on her cello, came in from the hallway. Gurney introduced her.
Asparagus, said Thrasher. Wise choice.
Excuse me?
I noticed your asparagus bed out there. Only vegetable worth the trouble of growing at home. Freshness, huge difference.
He glanced around again.
Might be a good idea to have a seat.
How about right here, suggested Gurney, gesturing to the chairs at the table. He added, we're eager to find out what this is all about.
Good. I'm hoping your interest will survive the answer.
With curious frowns, Gurney and Madeline took seats next to each other at the table. Thrasher remained standing on the opposite side.
First, a bit of background. As you know, my vocation is forensic pathology with a focus on determining the causes of untimely death. My avocation, however, is the examination of northeastern colonial life with a focus on its darker aspects, particularly the malignant synergy of slavery and psychopathology. I'm sure you're aware that slavery was not an exclusively southern phenomenon. In colonial New York City, in 1700, nearly half the households owned at least one slave. Chattel slavery, the buying and selling of human beings over whom the owner had absolute control, was widely accepted.
"We're aware of the history," said Madeline.
A glaring defect of history, as it is commonly taught, is that the events of an era are often seen acting upon one another in only very large terms. For example, the interaction between advances in mechanization and the movement of populations to manufacturing centers. We read about these interactions and think we're grasping the essence of an age. Or we read about slavery in the context of agricultural economics and we think we understand it, when in fact nothing could be further from the truth. It's possible to read a dozen books about it and never feel the horror of it, never even glimpse the malignant synergy I mentioned a moment ago.
"What synergy?" asked Madeline.
"The appalling ways in which some of society's ills combine with others."
"What are you getting at?"
"I wrote an article on the subject last year for a journal of cultural psychology. The title was Victims for Sale: Torture, Sexual Abuse, and Serial Murder in Colonial America. I'm working on another right now, detailing the confluence of psychopathic disorders and a legal system that permitted one person to own another."
"What does this have to do with us?"
"I'm coming to that. The average American's image of colonial America doesn't run much deeper than stolid-looking pilgrims in big black hats, happy Indians, brotherly love, religious freedom, and occasional hardship. Colonial reality, of course, was something else entirely. Filth, fear, starvation, ignorance, disease, superstition, the practice of witchcraft and the torture and hanging of witches, heresy trials, cruel punishments, banishments, absurd medical practices, pain and death everywhere, and, of course, all the major mental disorders and predatory behaviors, all rampant, all misunderstood. Psychopaths who—" Madeline broke in impatiently. "Dr. Thrasher—" He ignored the interruption. "The convergence of two great ills, the desire of the psychopath to exert total control over another person, to use, to abuse, to kill. Imagine that urge combined with the institution of slavery, a system that enabled the easy purchase of potential victims at a public market, men, women, and children for sale, objects to be employed at the owner's pleasure, human beings with hardly any more rights than farm animals, human beings with virtually no effective legal protection against constant rape and worse, men, women, and children whose deaths, accidental or intentional, few authorities would bother to seriously investigate."
"Enough," said Madeline. "I asked you a question. What does this have to do with us?"
Thrasher blinked in surprise, then replied matter-of-factly, "The old foundation David uncovered dates, in my opinion, to the very early 1700s. There were no settlements in this part of the state at that time. This was a frontier wilderness, the essence of the unknown, a place of savagery, danger, and isolation. No one would have chosen to live here, this far from a protective community, unless they were under constraint."
"Constraint?"
"The people who came here would have done so for one of two reasons. One, they were engaging in practices that would have been considered abhorrent to their community, and so came here to avoid possible exposure. Or two, they were exposed and banished." There was a silence broken by Gurney.
"What kind of practices are you talking about?"
"The objects you found indicate some involvement with witchcraft. That may have been the reason they were driven out of their original community. But I believe that witchcraft was the least of their transgressions. I believe the essence of what was happening in that house by your pond 300 years ago was what we would define today as serial murder." Madeline's eyes widened.
"What?"
2 years ago, I was called in to examine the buried remains of an early 18th-century house over by Marley Mountain. I found some items related to sorcery rituals.
but more significantly, there were iron shackles and other evidence of individuals having been held in captivity. There were several devices typically used in the torture of prisoners, including implements for breaking bones, extracting fingernails,